this meeting of the House Rules, Elections, and Public Affairs Committee to order. And we will first thing on our agenda today is Senate Bill 912, and I understand there are further amendments coming to the bill. We'll call Dennis. Welcome to the left. And we're under certain time constraints. We've got an hour and a half to get through the whole agenda, so if you keep it brief, I appreciate it.
I've got two sets of amendments. Dennis Mulvihill, Washington County. 912-2, drafting error. Line 4, first page, it changes it from an O to a P. What that effectively does, it says is that this is inserted in on top of 912 as it was originally written. And I've got one here, -3. It is so warm. And what it does is limit the effect of this change that I described the other day.
We have -3 for the committee.
To Washington County.
They're being photocopied currently as we speak. Another -3 that you had requested.
As I requested, would say that the amendment that I described the other day, which would allow a service district, county service district, to convert itself into a single purpose service district with a vote of the county commissioners, would be limited to Washington County only.
Any questions for Mr. Mogul here? Thank you very much.
Oh, and I should say that I'll speak for them to save time. Special District Association, legal organization, with this -3 amendment.
-3 amendment. Okay, that would be Burton Lees and Phil Fell.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Burton Weist. I'm here on behalf of Special Districts Association of Oregon. We talked with Washington County on this bill last night. In Washington County, after visiting with our special districts there, they do not have a problem with the bill. The reason for that is Washington County has a long history of regional service agencies, and they have many existing agreements that, in essence, allow this kind of operation that would occur under the bill to happen. The largest fire district in the state and the largest water district in the state are both in Washington County. The largest sewer district in the state are all in Washington County. So they have no objection to this measure. Our concern was other counties and what impact this measure would have on counties where ORS 195, so-called Senate Bill 122 agreements have been done, and where there were not the cordial relations between the counties, the cities, and the special districts, and what the implication of this would be for those areas. So we asked Washington County to prepare an amendment that would limit this bill only to Washington County, and if they did that, we would then be supportive of the bill, and our districts in Washington County would be supportive of the bill.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Philip Bell, League of Oregon Cities. Ditto, I spoke with a couple of cities out in Washington County this morning, and they're fine on the bill. We would like to see it restricted to Washington County, and although we haven't seen the language, I assume that it does that. And if that's the case, we certainly have no objection. It seems like it will be what people out there are interested in.
We do have some input from the Oak Lodge Sanitary District. Their comments were on the -1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, my comment on that?
Yes, Mr. Starr.
Since we have three amendments that limit this amendment to only Washington County, my sense is that the Oak Lodge Sanitary District is outside of Washington County and would not be affected by the changes that we're making in the -3 to 912.
Okay.
Alrighty.
Linda Modrell. Please introduce yourself to the record.
My name is Linda Modrell. I'm a commissioner, a county commissioner from Benton County. I was unable to attend the hearing on Tuesday because I was out of state, and so I was unable to testify in support of Senate Bill 912, which is a bill that I asked Senator Trow and Representatives Ross and Shetterly to introduce on behalf of the Benton County Commissioners. I'm just here today to answer any questions that you might have of me. My particular interest was the Human Services County Service District.
Okay. Any questions?
I have a question.
You have a star?
Just briefly, one quick question. This bill relates to human services.
Correct.
Do you have a definition for human services?
I intended it to be fairly broad rather than narrow. And human services, at least from my perspective, could take into account anything from trying to prevent elder abuse to teen centers. We're also particularly interested in young children who are demonstrating severe behavioral problems in preschool and in kindergarten and first grade. But it could also take into account some other things. What I was trying to avoid was to create a silo-type funding stream that as your priorities change, you'd be unable to shift your priorities.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 912 and maybe go to a work session with some of our members here.
We have seven votes.
Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1264. Mr. Graney and Cindy Finlayson and Ken Evans and Ken Armstrong.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. I'm Mike Graney. I'm Assistant Director of the Oregon Office of Energy. We're here in support of Senate Bill 1264. This bill was put together to provide greater encouragement for renewable resource development in Oregon, particularly energy using biomass and agricultural wastes, both for electric energy production and for ethanol production. The bill actually makes, very briefly, changes in three of our program areas, energy facility siting, our small-scale energy loan program, and our business tax credit program. I've handed out to you a detailed summary of the bill, including a section-by-section summary, as well as a letter in support from the Office of Economic Development. We mentioned very briefly the changes to our Energy Siting Council threshold of jurisdiction are consistent with what we have for electric generation. This would provide the same type of opportunities for both a ruling of exemption from the siting council for large facilities to produce ethanol and a clear delineation of small facilities that are exempt. The loan program changes are really technical changes to make it easier to make loans for biomass and other renewable resources, and the tax credit changes would also provide greater incentives. That's a very brief summary of the bill in the interest of your limited time. I'd be happy to go into more detail if there's any questions.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Cindy Finlayson. I represent Portland General Electric, and again, in the interest of your time, PGE supports this bill. Senate Bill 1264 represents good public policy. It simplifies government process and encourages both the public and private sector to utilize programs to develop and expand production of renewable resources. We support this bill wholeheartedly and have worked with my to move it forward. And if you have questions, I'm happy to answer them. And I have submitted my testimony, so it's not going to take too long.
Chair Simmons, members of the committee, my name is Ken Evans. My client and I have worked with Mike Rainey all session, so a good bill we requested earlier. It then promotes the technology that I think is in, on the threshold of good things for not only for the state for renewables, but for economic development in rural communities. Most of these facilities will be sited in rural communities, which is a real plus. So not to be belabor the point, this is a good bill, and we appreciate your support. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Armstrong, Executive Director of the Oregon Public Ports Association. I'm here today pinch-hitting for the Port of St. Helens, which is unable to attend today's committee hearing. Most of the information that they would communicate to you is represented in Ms. Finlayson's comments. I would just indicate the Port of St. Helens support for the bill, primarily the Energy Facility Siting Council streamlining, and the Ports Association supports it as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? All right. Well, we will see no one else trying to testify on this bill. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1264 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1264.
Mr. Chair.
President Starr.
I move Senate Bill 1264 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Well, you've heard the motion. To move Senate Bill 1264 to the floor of the House to due pass recommendations. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so moved. Any volunteers for carriers? Okay. President Starr? Okay, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 1264. Pardon me. We will now open a work session on Senate Bill 912. We held a public hearing on that earlier. We have a DAF-3. Amendments before you,
Mr. Chair.
President Starr.
Move the DAF-3 amendments to Senate Bill 912.
Calls a motion before us to move the DAF-3 amendments to Senate Bill 912. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Chair.
President Fire.
Let me get to the correct bill here. The DAF-3 amendments are the amendments that narrow the scope. Is the intent to also adopt the DAF-2 amendments?
No.
It's the DAF-3. Okay. I don't support the DAF-3 amendments. If the bill were to move in a civil form, I'd support it. But the DAF-3 amendments are designed to take care of an event that may happen sometime in the future. If a ballot measure qualifies for the ballot, and then if that ballot measure then passes, the DAF-3 amendments would be needed. I think that is a little bit too forward-thinking, I guess. You're passing legislation based on something that may pass in the year 2000. If, and then, in fact, that ballot measure was to pass, there would be required, I'm sure, implementation language of some sort by the 2001 legislature. So to be running scared of a ballot measure on the basis of a proposed initiative is ludicrous at best. So I can't support that amendment.
Further discussion?
I agree with my friend from Malala. I don't think this is ludicrous at all. In fact, I think that it's prudent of us to act on this in this manner, in that in a case that the 2001 legislature would have to adopt something in retrospect, and you'd have a period of time where you'd have a significant service district in Washington County that would be in legal limbo, and I think that this is a prudent and not ludicrous in any way, shape, or form.
Further discussion on the motion? Person Devlin?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, to cite an example of that, well, I know it's probably not the intent of the petitioner to have this impact. Should this make it to the ballot, USA issues revenue bond virtually all the time. And obviously, about bond council would have to inform people that that there is a potential measure that could impact the structure of that governmental entity that might put a cloud on their bonds. So taking this preventative action now is probably well, I wish it wasn't necessary, is probably in the long term a beneficial, proactive step to take.
Further discussion? You call the roll, please.
Representative Atkinson, aye. Representative Beck,
aye.
Representative Byer,
no.
Representative Devlin,
aye.
Representative Carmel,
aye.
Representative Gardner,
aye.
Representative Manning,
excuse.
Representative Kiersey,
aye.
Representative Starr,
aye.
Representative Welch,
excuse.
Representative Williams,
aye.
Representative Sitter. Aye. Having received the required majority, Senate Bill 912 goes before the House to be passed recommendation. Okay, all right. Now we have a motion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Mr. Scarf?
I move Senate Bill 912 as amended to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Okay, you have another motion, colleagues. Any discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. McGuire?
In objection, I guess I'll put it in a different light. I know there's going to be a ballot measure or there's a proposed initiative going to be on to, again, restrict clerk cutting. I don't think it'd be prudent for me to go out and cut every tree I have between now and November of 2000 just in case a clerk has made the ballot. Same argument, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Beck.
I can assure my colleague from Malala that if there was a serious prospect of an anti-clear cutting measure passing, that a lot of people could go to do just that.
Mr. Chair, there was a serious prospect too in the 99 ballot, and many people did not do that, but we're not talking about initiatives that have made the ballot. We're talking about a proposed initiative. This hasn't even begun, they haven't got signatures yet. I mean, this is way out there.
Further discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Atkinson.
Aye.
Representative Beck.
Aye.
Representative Byer.
No.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Gardner.
Aye.
Representative Manning.
Excuse.
Representative Kiersey.
Aye.
Representative Starr.
Aye.
Representative Welch.
Excuse.
Representative Williams.
Aye.
Representative Henry.
Aye. The volunteer for carrier. Mr. Williams will be the carrier on the bill. And the work session is closed. And we will go down to Senate Bill 867 and open the public hearing. And Mr. Sizemore. Mr. Sizemore, have you seen the Dash 5 amendment?
Is it 5 or 4?
4.
There's a 4 and a 5.
4 and 5.
I don't think I've seen the 5. For the record, I'm Bill Sizemore from Oregon Taxpayers United. Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. What did Dash 5 say? Are you supposed to ask the question?
Representative Mannix will come in and give us a briefing on the Dash 5. It's a tag-along piece. It's not a gut and stuff, it's just a stuff. So if you'd care to give us your testimony on the bill and the Dash 4s will allow you an opportunity to come on the Dash 5 should you so desire.
Let me just give you, if you would, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a rundown on what Senate Bill 867 is all about. In 1995, the legislature passed Senate Bill 926, which removed from the ballot the old question form that often contained double negatives and confusing language that a person would read, and they would know what they believed, but they wouldn't know whether to vote yes or no to get it because of the language. And we adopted, or you adopted, a statute that equates that question with a result of a yes vote, 15 words that says, here's what happens if you vote yes, 15 words that says, here's what happens if you vote no. And that replaced the question and has been very popular, very well received. in the last, during the hearings in the Senate, the Attorney General's office came in and they agreed that they have had positive response to that change in the law. But at the time that Senate Bill 926 was written and passed, we did not have vote by mail. And so the number of words used in ballot titles to explain, put a caption on the measure, and the result of a yes vote and the result of a no vote, the result statements were limited to 15 words each because there simply, with a lot of voting machines in a lot of counties, they simply could not put any more words than that on the ballot. But since we have vote by mail, this is an opportunity to loosen up the word restrictions so that the Attorney General in drafting and in some cases the Supreme Court in drafting ballot titles can state what a measure does in easier to understand, more common everyday language. They're encouraged in this bill to use articles and conjunctions if omitting them would make it confusing. I'll tell you, you'll never find, in fact, I probably couldn't find you an example out of probably 100 ballot titles I've looked at of a conjunction in a ballot title, because they try to use every word so sparingly, so carefully, that they just don't use articles and conjunctions. Because we now have vote by mail, we want to open that up to 25 words and let them state what a measure does, result of a yes, result of a no vote, in easy and commonly understood language, and instead of in these chalky sentences that the Attorney General has been forced to use because of the overly restrictive word limitations. Pretty much that simple, and I don't know of any opposition to the bill in its current form. When it passed out of the Senate committee, there was some opposition. The Attorney General opposed it, and we were encouraged by the Senate Rules Committee to meet, work out a compromise. We did, and the Dash 4 amendments are language that we have agreed to, and so the bill passed the Senate, well, with the understanding that these amendments would be made in the House if everyone agreed to it. And as I said, both the Attorney General's office and us as sponsors of the bill, we as sponsors of the bill have agreed to this language.
Righty, thank you. Question from Mr. Sizemore? Question Williams?
Mr. Chairman, it's not a question, but it's interesting. I don't know who provided us this sheet, but if you go down and you start counting the number of words used in the result of yes vote and no vote, it's tough to find one that doesn't use either 14 or 15 words. I mean, they are at the barest of minimum now in explaining it, and it is, I think, sometimes written in such a style that it's difficult to understand because of that limitation. And inserting a the or an and or some other kind of an article probably would help. Measure 64 may be the only one that I've counted. The result of the no vote, I think you get no vote pertains current regulations concerning timber harvest practices. That's about as concise as it gets on this list. All the others either are, I think, 14 or 15 counted.
Thank you.
If I'm fair, Mr. Sizemore, under current law, under the 15 words, you're saying conjunctions, articles, are included in that 15, so hence you get this really cryptic statement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Randall, that's correct. The 15 words have to include everything. With 25, they can use articles in conjunction. They will count towards the 25, but they will have the words free to use them. Currently, they simply do not. This runs into a particular problem. A state that a yes vote says that the measure does two things. When you get to the no vote, they don't often even have the words to say that the no vote rejects this and rejects that. Instead, they just say it rejects this and then semicolon lists the next thing that it rejects, but a voter could easily conclude that it rejects the first one but does the second one. So that the only difference between the two is the first thing that it rejects. This is kind of an insider game, and as you know, it's something that I've been involved in for some time. And I can say that for all parties, regardless of their agendas, this will make a fairer system, an easier a ballot language that will be easier for the average voter to understand.
Could you also comment on page 2 of the bill, why we're expanding the word, expanding the number of words from 85 to 125 on the summary of the measure itself?
Mr. Chair, Representative Randall, the same exact reason. Edwards,
Tavares, well, two last names.
I'm glad I didn't know who you are.
Just in case the record, they don't know who that is.
That's right. The same exact reason, what the Attorney General has to do in the, whoever drafts the ballot, that has to do in the summary, is not just explain the main thing that this measure does, but he or she also has to give as best they can a description of the entire measure. And again, they're having to do that with very choppy clauses, clause after clause that you almost can't tell. Like when they make the transition from what current law is to what this measure would do, they don't even use the word this. It just says, usually, almost always, it just says measure does this. They don't. You can't even tell you've made the transition from current law status quo to what this measure would do. In the local ballot measures, not statewide, but local ballot measures, I'm not sure, but I think they have like 175 words for their summary. And so it was necessary before that they had these limitations, but they're not so necessary now. A lot of, just for your edification, under the current system, with voting in the precincts, about half of the counties in the state of Oregon do not have the summary on the ballot. They actually just post that in the voting booth for you to see if you can find it when you vote. Now, with vote by mail, I'm assuming that even though the ballot won't have that necessarily printed out, the sheet that you get that summarizes that measure will be able to have the whole caption, both the result in yes, yes and no votes, and the summary all there for you to make a decision. I think overall that's got to be a step forward. More information the voter has when he or she votes, the better.
Thank you very much.
Sorry, I'm not the realistic. There is something here that just caught my eye on line 7 on page 2, which talks about it's normally used in written, if I'd be writing, but anyway, or conversational language. Is that going to open up more challenges to the description? I mean, I that seems a little subjective, but I guess I'm going off the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, what the bill said in 1995, Senate Bill 926, was that those two statements had to be simple and understandable. And all that does is say what standards are we using for simplicity. And we're saying language that is an everyday elector would understand, that's used in everyday conversational language. That's kind of been the understanding before, but because it's not been in statute, what we meant by simple and understandable, the court has at times debated that issue, and it's better just to settle it here because they look, I can tell you from experience, they look very much to the guidance of the bill, of the actual statutory language when they draft ballot titles.
So, Mr. Chair, so if I run this through my word processing and I want to run it through the grammar, which usually tells you the level, saying it's below 10th grade or something like that. Is that sort of what we're looking at? Something that's very understandable?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, yes. That's
Representative Edwards.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Yeah. The Dash-4 amendment replaces the first page, all of Section 1, which is the line 7 is Section 1 on the second page.
Thank you.
Yeah. Further discussion on the while you're here, Representative Manick, you're the proponent of the -5. You'd like to comment on the -5, and then Mr. Sargent would like to comment on that.
I don't know if Mr. Sargent had a chance to look at this.
This
is designed to be a bipartisan effort to loosen up on one edge of the campaign laws, actually, just generally speaking. I'm sick and tired of campaigns not being able to have flexibility in this gray area between the volunteer and the volunteer who receives a stipend as opposed to the regular employee. And routinely, candidates for a variety of positions and people involved in campaigns may receive a small stipend for their services. If you pay someone to put up lawn signs, however, you better make sure that you did your W-9 and signed them up to be an employee. If you pay somebody to give you some advice about how to put together your brochure, you better make sure they have an independently established business or else you better have hired them as your employee. If you want to have petition circulators who are being paid by the signature and just told that they can do whatever they want anywhere, you better watch out or they better be considered your employees. The bureaucratic requirements that are imposed on campaigns are extensive. This would not apply to your person who's in the office working regular hours or someone who's subject to your direction and control. The traditional concept for an employee is someone who's subject to your direction and control. I get to tell employee X, you will arrive at work at this time, you will work these hours, you will do these duties. That person's an employee. The way this is written, this would apply, though, to the person that you say, look, I'd like you to get 100 lawn signs up around the county, and I'll pay you, I'm making this up, you know, I'll pay you a dollar a sign to get them up, or I'd like you to help me put together my media campaign, and I'll pay you a stipend to help with your time, that kind of approach. It makes it clear that if you're doing this, it can't be, you can't restrict that person's capability to be working with anyone else, except the more traditional thing of saying, look, you can't work for my opponent. Or if you're in favor of a certain ballot measure, no, you can't work for the other side. That's a fair restriction. But otherwise, they're free to work for any campaign. They can strategize with any campaign. The reason I mention that as a gray area is because right now we have black and white lines, and there's no gray area that's recognized at all in the law. And what happens is everyone errs on the side of caution, or at least they should, and they should hire everybody as an employee unless the person has a freestanding business office and can show that they have regular clients, et cetera, et cetera. This is designed then for the more informal campaign structure and allows people to arrange for someone that should be brought in and allows them to be considered an independent contractor, but then requirements are stated here in the amendments. They're pretty precise. This can't be done on a permanent basis. It has to be for a specific candidate, petition, political party, or measure. Hey, you're working for this group. It's got to be timed towards an election process or a campaign of some kind. The person has to be free from direction and control other than following election laws and completing strategy. So if you say, look, our strategy is I want to have a lawn sign every five blocks, or I want this many in the neighborhood, that's fine. But you can't be telling them, hey, here's the deal. You've got to go out and do this kind of work. You've got to do it this way, et cetera, et cetera. They're free to do it in whatever fashion is appropriate. They have to be able to set their own hours. That's one of the most traditional elements of independent contractors. That means you can't tell them when they're working. It's up to them to decide when they're going to work. And finally, that they're free to work for other campaigns or committees unless it's directly opposing your activity. I'm presenting it to the committee because I think it's a good broad-based approach. I don't like the idea that campaign workers are potentially subjected to the employment laws and all of the other laws, especially when we're dealing in many cases with short-term small operations. And so this is simply my effort to bring a proposal to the committee that would allow us to allow some more flexibility, somewhat similar to golf caddies being able to be independent contractors, which is in the statute, or newspaper carriers.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Mannix can assure me that he has the votes to pass this. I'd be happy to support it. I have a lot of interest in because we use a lot of paid petitioners, and those people being not being constantly pursued by the Employment Division to make those people employees. Working in campaigns, like as a candidate when I ran for governor, it was not so much of an issue. We had volunteers and we had people who were actual employees, and we had to almost flip a coin as to when were they, if a person was working as a general contractor, as a independent contractor, and when they were working as an employee. I'm sure you've all been there. Well, at what point are they one and what point are the other? With paid petitioners, which we do a lot of, that's an issue that will not go away as long as the Employment Division can pursue them as independent, try to make them employees, they will. I can tell you that, and we have put a number of measures on the ballot using paid petitioners, we have not been pursued, if you will, and they've not been able to find grounds for making any of our petitioners, and that's hundreds of them, employees. But other petitioning groups have lawsuits and expensive legal bills
trying to differentiate between whether they're their employees or independent contractors. We have no control whatsoever over anything that our petitioners do. They are as independent as an independent contractor can be, and yet we anticipate that we will be harassed about this eventually. I would wholeheartedly support this amendment if Representative Mannix has counted heads to see that he has the support to pass it, though I don't want to see this worthwhile bill go down if this amendment would pull it there.
Further questions? This is Gardner.
Mr. Chair, are we in work session? Or just...
No, we're in public hearing.
Okay. I just simply want to make a statement that I'm fundamentally opposed to independent contractors, and this would virtually open up possibly hundreds of more people to being independent contractors and not being covered by unemployment insurance, workers' compensation. And some of these people work for, 1 year or longer period sometimes. You have employees working on campaigns that are employed full-time and are employed for long periods of time, and this would possibly apply to them as well as far as being independent contractors.
Yeah.
Mr. Clivesmore, I'm actually willing to look at some latitude in this area, but probably not as much in that amendment. But one other question I had is, this, I don't want to get too much into your practices in terms of initiatives, but just curiosity, and that you haven't been really had a problem with this issue. Do you normally, as independent contractors, employ your own signature takers, or do you contract with one of the national firms?
Mr. Chair, Representative Devlin, we contract with primarily with, I would say, at least 80% of our work. We contract with petition coordinators here in Oregon who are Oregon companies. We do not, I have never signed a contract that I can recall with any of the big national firms that come in from out of state. If I may respond to your question, there's and expand a little bit on my answer, and then I would be happy to sit down. The issue is seems so cut and dry until you get into the minutiae of it. But I will tell you, if you have a petitioner that's petitioning for you for pay, and you make that petitioner employee, you have to pay them minimum wage. And yet, this petitioner is probably petitioning for 5 or 10 other petitions at the same time. That's just a fact of life. Now, I don't know which one of them owes that person minimum wage, or if they all pay them 55 cents or 65 cents an hour. I don't know how that works out, but I can tell you it is impossible for you to deal with 100 people who are all working for 10 different petition drives at the same time and for you to say they are employed. In spite of Representative Gardner's maybe instinctive objection to independent contractors, those laws exist for a reason. And sometimes that is what they really, really are. Totally outside of your control, working for different companies at the same time. They may be on your job for 30 minutes one and then off to another job for 2 hours and to another one. And when a person is out there petitioning, unless we pay them by the signature and as independent contractors, the laws suddenly become nonsense. Who owes them workers' comp? Who's responsible for covering them? Which one of those 10? Because they're actually working for all of them at the same time. Who owes the minimum wage? If you do not allow some latitude in regard to people who are working on campaigns in a short-term on a short-term basis, you have laws that eventually become absurd. Thank you.
Thank you, questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Sherman.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Schumann. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'm speaking to the Dash 4 amendments, and I simply want to confirm what Mr. Sizemore said. Mr. Sizemore has worked in conjunction with the Attorney General and the Department of Justice, and we support Dash 4 amendments. We think it's a good reform. It gives us some extra words.
What did you say, Mr. Schumann?
We're not in your session, but I just have to stay in here and say with this assurance, I'm fine on moving with this dash four. I have more concern of adding a whole new piece to this.
Okay. There's no further questions from the committee. We'll close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 867.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Manning.
I move adoption of the A4 amendment.
Colleagues, have a motion for us to adopt the A4 amendments to Senate Bill 867. Any discussion? Clerk, please call the roll. There is a typo, colleagues, on page 2, on line 9.
And the recall bill
of the dash, the A4 amendment, you pointed out to me. To the extent practicable, it's supposed to be changed to practical.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, either word would be appropriate. Practicable or practical is okay.
Practicable works.
Unless LC has a style manual.
Yeah, they've suggested that we match it up with the practical on line 17.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
It's splitting hairs, I understand.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman. I move that we amend or correct the A4 amendments to change practicable to the less desirable practical in order to be consistent with the statute.
Mr. Chairman, I would be safer, but to do the conceptual amendment, we have to suspend the rule.
That is correct.
This is a technical amendment rather than a conceptual amendment. I appreciate Reverend Wynn's point, but this is a Scrivener's error that we are correcting.
Mr. Chairman, demand the ruling of the chair.
What a parliamentary inquiry.
Yeah, parliamentary inquiry. Can we call Ramona down for this? What I'm going to do is err on the side of recklessness here and go with a technical Scrivener's error correction rather than seek unanimous consent. If we can, for suspension of the rules, without objection, we can change the word practicable to practical at the request of legislative counsel. We will do so. If there is objection, then we will not. So is there any objection? Okay.
Seems like the practical solution, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, please note that. Okay. We are still in work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Maddox.
Out of deference to Mr. Sizemore, I'm not going to move the A5 amendment because sidebar discussion shows me that it creates some consternation and concern. Is that fine with you?
No, I didn't hear talking to you.
Well, I was talking with him.
Okay.
All right, so I will move the bill.
Representative Mannix, I'd be happy to give you an opportunity to set this bill over and give you a chance to lobby some members of the committee or the House if you chose to.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman. My discernment is that there would be continued concern, and it would create some unnecessary baggage for Mr. Sizemore's proposal, and I don't want to do that. I appreciate the consideration.
So we need a motion.
Mr. Chairman.
President.
I move the bill to the floor with a due pass as amended.
As amended before the due pass recommendation. Colleagues, you've heard the motion. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beck.
I just want a note of irony that in an era where the modern media has and the advertisers have gotten us down to about 3 words on just about everything, I am struck, maybe happily struck, for actually making our new volumes of ballot measures as more words. So just an interesting footnote on what we're doing.
Enjoy the English language. We'll just add a few more words. Further discussion. President Devlin.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be voting for this and voting for it on the floor, but just it has a relating clause relating to elections, and maybe we should let the good senator know that we're passing one of his bills onto the floor, so maybe he will consider some of our elections-related bills in this committee.
Well, we do have other vehicles of our own that we're using. We may have no more Senator Sarge over here yet.
Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm.
We could always take all the House bills relating to elections and add them to this bill as an amendment to save Senator Starr from time.
There we go.
Only the ones that have already passed that had wide support. Just a wild and woolly idea.
We did some initiative reform stuff that's sitting over in this committee, I believe.
I bet Mr. Sizemore would love that.
Mr. over there, won't you vote for it?
Mr. Chair, on that issue, I just like to commend Mr. Sizemore for the power, I guess, he has. That he proposes an initiative. He hasn't started collecting signatures yet, and he's got special districts running scared and changing the law in case one of his ballot measures makes the ballot.
Representative Starr.
Point of order. This bill is not dealing with the previous.
It was the previous bill, I think, Representative Fire was referring to.
See no further discussion. Please call the roll.
Representative Atkins.
Aye.
Representative Beck.
Aye.
Representative Meyer.
Aye.
Representative Devlin.
Aye.
Representative Edwards.
Aye.
Representative Gardner.
Aye.
Representative Mann.
Aye.
Representative Piercy.
Aye.
Representative Starr.
Aye.
Representative Welch.
Aye.
Representative Williams.
Aye.
And Senate Bill 867 goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation that a volunteer for a carrier.
I'll volunteer.
Give him an arm muscle over it.
Oh, you must.
I'll give Representative Devlin. We'll set it up there. We already gave him the start of the day. So we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 867. And go to the next item on our agenda. Can we sign up to testify on Senate Bill 115A? If not, we'll just skip over it. We're not going to go to a work session on that bill today. There's more amendments coming to that piece. There are amendments, things being tagged onto the bill. If you would just as soon come back and you see the amendments, that's fine. Or you can testify today. Okay. Open a public hearing on 115A.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Snyder. I'm a deputy district attorney here in Marion County, and I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We support this bill, however, with one reservation. We are concerned about the inclusion of references to law enforcement agencies in creating standards and procedures of how to do minor decoy operations. We certainly support the concept of a coordinated effort between the Oregon Liquor Commission and law enforcement agencies, but to mandate particular standards and procedures to law enforcement agencies is something that does concern us. Here in Salem, we do have the Salem Police Department has a street crimes unit that does do minor decoy operations. They have standards and procedures already in place that we, as the district attorney's office, has supported and has approved. And we're concerned that there would be perhaps some conflicts between what we're already doing in our county and in other counties across the state. There's the same type of concern. So we support this. But do hope that with amendments, perhaps there might be some consideration by the committee to strike the references to law enforcement agencies being part of any mandated standards and procedures in the bill. And I'd be happy to answer any questions about that that particular concern by the ODA.
President Piercy.
Do we know if the amendments are addressing our issues or other issues?
Amendments.
We don't know.
Yeah, we do, but the amendments are not addressing that issue.
Right.
Any questions for Ms. Snyder?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the
committee. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 115A and go to a public hearing on SJM-9. And Senator Marilyn Shannon is here.
I should
my partner's not here, Earth Celestial. Are you here for Earth? Can you come up with
me?
Good. Hi, how are you doing? My name is Marilyn Shannon, Senator in Senate District 15. And SJM 9 will send a letter to Memorial to Congress saying that Oregon recalls our call for a constitutional convention for a balanced budget amendment. And what happens from time to time, and I don't know who these people are, but there are some people that want us to have a constitutional convention. And whatever seems to be popular at the time, that's the horse they ride, in my vernacular. And I think this passed in the 70s, but then it was for a balanced budget amendment. They wanted a constitutional convention for a balanced budget amendment. Well, Congress has balanced the budget, passed a plan. You don't need a constitutional convention for that. Then they put out to the states a call for a constitutional convention for deciding how to use the lands in the West. That was the 95 session. And then there was, because there's two ways you can get a Constitution Convention. And then, I don't know if you, I think it was in 96, it was on the ballot. We wanted a Constitutional Convention to discuss term limits. And that failed by 48-52 at the ballot box in November of 96. And so that's what this does. Several states that had sent in their call for a constitutional convention for a balanced budget amendment have recalled theirs, and we would just be one of the states. And the reason I'm very concerned about this is because there is not a law, I mean a real legal authority in the land. And I've read letters, I don't have one with me, from Supreme Court justices and et cetera, that once a constitutional convention is convened, there is no way you can limit it to one issue. And frankly, I think we have a great constitution, great system, and I urge an aye vote so we can send this memorial to Congress.
A legal question. Why is it that a memorial that was passed over 10 years ago or 20 years ago binds this legislature? Why do we have to make a statement?
Okay.
Memorials, as I understand it, is a statement made by that body.
Okay.
Why do we have to speak to it?
Okay, because sometimes, like the Equal Rights Amendment, they send it out and they give the state 7 years to ratify it. And that one, they extended it for 3.5 years. But there is no time limit on this. As soon as they have a call from, or these memorials from 38 states, then they have to call the Constitutional Convention. There is no time, you read the Constitution in the U.S., there's no time limit on the calls, and that's why the calls have, people have decided they didn't want to go this way, then they said we want ours back. In fact, I think it hasn't even been adjudicated that if they could send them back. I don't know that there's a provision in the Constitution to return your call, but we want ours back anyway.
I understand that the call for constitutional convention and the ratification of how many states. I didn't realize that once we send that call out, once it's open-ended,
it's
good for eternity.
Uh-huh.
Hmm. Is it possible, do you have a copy of what was sent out? I mean, is it basically what you're describing, which is...
This is it. It explains that we want a call for a constitutional convention to pass a balanced budget amendment. That's simple. Very simple.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Do you have any idea how many states have sent these memorials in that are, what it's added up to at this point?
Well, I think at one time there were 35. Maybe you know the exact.
I have no idea.
But I think 8 or 9 have recalled their call. And it's not that we're at the threshold or the threat of it, but we just want it back. That's just my...
This is Devlin.
Mm-hmm. Right there. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Shannon, although in
Article 5,
summary line here, it seems to imply that it addresses this area. This is, but the bill actually doesn't. I'm speaking a little bit in riddles here, but this is in reference specifically, the operative language of the resolution is to a call for a constitutional convention on a balanced budget.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is not actually addressed. I don't know if it actually passed through the Senate, but the last session of legislature, we passed a resolution to Congress urging them to, you know, send an amendment out to the states asking for a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution. Mm-hmm. That's not calling for a constitutional convention. And although in the explanation up here it says it urges Congress to disregard, in reality, this is only affecting those calls for an actual constitutional convention. Is that correct?
It is only referring to one specific call, a call for a convention to convene to consider a balanced budget amendment. Because it's my understanding, the calls all have to be identical. Okay. So a call for a term limit would not count for a call for a constitutional convention.
Thank you.
It was 1977.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't have that answer.
Okay. The only thing I was, Mr. Chairman, the only thing I was regarding to is when you get up into the summary section here, it says, rescind previous memorial conduct and subject to requiring balanced budget. Mm-hmm. And I think it's simply just referencing the one down here, because I know we've passed other memorials simply calling for them to do a...
You're absolutely right, Representative Jeffrey. Yeah. This is just the one that calls for a constitutional convention. We don't want to recall that other one. That was a memorial.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Arthur Chinitz. I'm Director of Research and Education for the Oregon AFL-CIO. And today I'm sitting in for Irv Fletcher. This is not a bill... this is not an issue that I'm familiar with, so I won't be able to field any questions. I'll just read his testimony, and that'll be it. I'm glad to have a constitutional expert with me. The Oregon AFL-CIO supports passage of SAM-9 as it's presently written. SAM-9, as we understand it, would supersede SAM-2, enacted by the 1977 Oregon Legislative Assembly, which called for a federal constitutional convention to prepare an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that would require a balanced federal budget. Our opposition to a federal constitutional convention is mainly predicated on the fact that once a convention is assembled, there are no prior restraints on what part of the Constitution might be amended. In addition, Congress has already the necessary authority to balance the budget without resorting to a special convention. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on SCM-9 and open a work session on SCM-9.
Chair, I move SCM-9 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Christine Byer moves SCM-9 to the floor to do pass recommendations. Any discussion? Yeah. Please call the roll. Representative Starr, I dropped the gavel. Do you want to vote? Representative Gardner, do you want to vote?
What's the bill?
SCM-9.
We're voting up and down.
Yes, up and down.
Aye.
2 years ago. Representative Starr votes aye. Representative Gardner?
Aye.
Representative Gardner votes aye.
Representative Gardner was the vote when we needed to pass the bill, so we appreciate him coming in.
Oh, thank you.
The gut and stuff that we just had.
Oh,
yeah.
And,
in Oregon.
That was it. That was it.
Richard Starr has asked to have the privilege of carrying this bill. And we'll assign Star the carrier then, or anybody under duress. So we will close the public hearing then on SCM-9, and the amendments for House Bill 2989 are not ready yet. I've been informed. So seeing no other business before the committee, we are adjourned.
Chair, if I can just
publicly thank the members of the committee who voted for my bill today after quite a grueling. I know some of you stuck with me and some of you didn't.
I had a question.
I do want to get it.
I did
appreciate it. It was not...
Was it worth it?